Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this very special edition of G Live, broadcasting to you a little later than usual, but tonight is a special night because, as you can see, it's a little bit of a different setup. We have our very, very special guest, all the way live from his home in Canada, am I right?
Toronto.
Yep, awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Eric Lang.
Hey everyone, how are you?
We just wanted to touch base with you and see how you are currently. We know that everyone in the world is undergoing some sort of quarantine with the current situation. How's life so far there in Canada, especially since you just moved back from Singapore?
We moved back from Singapore to Toronto, I think 2 weeks before the lockdown. So it basically followed us all the way here. I mean, hopefully not exactly followed us, right? Everybody's locked down here. We've been social distancing like crazy. Everybody stayed at home. Most businesses are closed. But there's no panic. It's been pretty smooth overall. Obviously, everybody's working at a slightly lower capacity, but we're adjusting. I've been freelancer for 20 years, so I've been working at home for that long. So this is nothing new to me.
Yeah, I was gonna ask what the workload for you was like. It seems like you're used to it and you're doing fine. But has work like being with come on, has it affected your work being in quarantine for so long?
Oh, sure it has, of course, right? So everybody's at home, so there's no. The main thing that I've changed is that we're obviously not flying between offices anymore, right? So I don't, I'm not spending time in the Brazil office, but we're spending a lot more time on Zoom, and doing video meetings, and it's been okay. The playtesting's been interesting. We've been doing a lot more digital playtesting, which works. It's just a little inefficient. So we're getting used to the fact that it's taking us longer to do our job. But other than that, we're still like in pretty bright spirits, all things considered.
All right. That's good. You mentioned that you guys are doing a lot of Zoom meetings. That's how we're doing this show right here. And a lot of online testing. Real quick, before we jump into the main topic, you know, Ankh, Marvel United, how has the digital interface been for you? A lot of questions from our community is related to that. So one of them is from one of our curators, Ben. Ben has been asking, how have you been dealing with being mostly an analog game designer given the lockdown? What's that like for you guys?
Yeah, it's tough. It's rough, I'm not gonna lie. It's rough. But I'm still making prototypes, right? Like I have all my, like, you know, I have all my bits, right? All my cards. I still have my printer. So everything, I basically reverted to the state that I was in before. I was in the office in Singapore. I have all the equipment here. So I just, and all my toys, so I can make prototypes here. Playtesting live is a different issue, so I can't do that. We use Tabletop Simulator for the most part, we've gotten very good at making good prototypes out of it. The issue, of course, is that, you know, it's while it's a very good medium, you can test many things, but you can't test haptics, right? So luckily, we're in the middle of so many projects that are deep in development. So we already know the haptics work. We've already tested them extensively. So now we're just testing for balance and for balance and bugs. And that's just a grind.
All right.
So yeah.
Oh, okay. I love it. I love it.
At any point, like since you guys use Tabletop Simulator, any digital platform to do your testing, at any point in any of the games, did you think that maybe we should add like a digital component to it, like what you did with XCOM, having an app? Or
I always think about that, right? But So it's interesting because, so yes, it's always considered, but we don't add it just because you should. Well, sorry, not because you should, just because you can. Like if we're going to do a game with a digital component, it has to be because it really needs that digital component. It cannot exist without that component. And I mean, we've always got stuff cooking on the side. But you know, right now we're working on Ankh right now, which is a big Kickstarter game. I'm not going to deviate so far from Blood Rage and Rising Sun. We're working on a couple of games that are just so designed for, you know, the big, come on, Kickstarter model, right? Lots of great toys, lots of great haptics. I think that the trying to do a digital component would probably distract from that. But in the future, absolutely, why not?
Yeah.
I think that's the dream. I kind of miss the way you designed XCOM. So XCOM was just a little short on the figurines. It had a few, but that's the dream for me right now. Just that integration plus all of the little toys. Well, big toys, some of them. Hopefully, yeah. hopefully that comes down in the future, sooner than later. But yeah, that's a little bit of a taste of our main topic. But real quick, I gotta say, we hit about 200 viewers in the show, so amazing. Thank you guys so much. You can send your questions over to Eric in the chat. Real quick, let me just say hi to Michael, to Carlos, to Mikey, to Miggy. You guys are awesome. Just let us know what you want to ask Eric, because we're going to talk about some Ankh, we're going to talk some Marvel United, and of course, we're just going to close up here talking about the quarantine situation. It's a worldwide pandemic. Before we start talking more board games, Eric, I got to know, what do you miss most about being outside?
Oh God! So it's twofold. It's actually two things, because it's what I miss about being outside and the tropics. My wife and I lived in Singapore for 3 years until just last month. Now we're home back in Canada, so it's, you know, this is home. We love it here. All our friends and family are here. I miss seeing them though. We can't see them very often. I'm sort of just sad about the tropics. I love it. Like I love 30 degree weather. I love the humidity. I love the beach. I love the afternoon thunderstorms. I love going out to eat at the hawker centers. I miss that greatly. That would be alleviated a little bit, of course, if we're in Canada. Here everything is familiar. I know what everything is, and Toronto's a great city. Too, we're right in the heart of downtown. There's nothing's open, so I miss the, like, all the cliche stuff, right? Like I miss going out for a walk, going out to the record store, going out to the music store, going to the game shop and just hanging out and talking shop and playing games for fun. It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah. I mean,
I know one more thing you miss, Eric. You miss Mala.
So for a little while my social media bio was stated, all I want to do is wear shorts and eat spicy food, and it's kind of true. that's my final form. I've only been to the Philippines twice, right? But I miss the food there. I miss my adobo, my bulalo, yum, yum, yum.
Basically, the way that things are, whether you're from the east, whether you're from the west, it's just everything feels like a ghost town, and that's what I can't stand.
That's right.
That's what makes me. That's what I miss not feeling, because when a place feels like a ghost town, it just eats at your soul. But yeah, let's not dwell on that. Let's jump into the main topic of tonight, and I think. Are you tired? Let's real quick before we jump in. Are you tired about answering questions about Marvel United and Ankh? Because you're I don't know, maybe years in development for either game. And now that you've gone public, the Kickstarter for both, for Marvel United has come and gone. And Ankh, you're right in the middle of it. Are the questions, like, do you hear them repeatedly, or are some of them still fresh to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, of course, right? But I mean, that's the hazards of being a professional, right? But you're right. Marvel, we've been in development on Marvel United since just shortly after I joined Come On, so about 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And Ankh, I mean, I started working on Ankh before I started at Come On. So it's been a long process. But so, yes, of course, I do a lot of shows, I do a lot of interviews, but it's still exciting for me to finally actually be able to talk about the game in detail. Mm-hmm. Right? One of the most frustrating elements of working on these games under wraps for so long is I don't get to talk about it in public. So I'm nowhere near tired of it.
All right, let's go. Let's see if we here on the show can unlock some weird questions that maybe haven't been asked yet. Let's start off with a few personal curiosities, because me and Hans we went back and forth, and like, Hans, here's some of the questions that I want to ask, and he's like, here's some of mine, and of course we're gonna get some questions from the crowd as well. But
sure.
First off the bat, let's talk about the chibi aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from? Why is that the direction for Marvel United?
So, yeah, interesting. So that actually came before the game. So Marvel United is a different beast, of course, right? It's a licensed game, obviously. So and it's one of the rare cases where I as the lead designer actually was actually took part in some of the licensing meetings and got to meet with some of the executives from Disney, because I go to all the conventions. We met them there, and so we pitched this game as a long shot, to be honest, right? We were like, they'll never say yes to this, but we knew that they've made a lot of Marvel games, and we needed something that would be an obvious distinguishing factor, and we weren't sure how well they know games, so we had to do something visual. We know we're really good at chibi, right? Like, it's Arcadia Quest is one of our most popular games.
Yep.
And we have a stable of incredibly talented artists. So they, we did a couple tests. Like, what would it look like if they look like this? Now, I've seen cute Marvel before, but I've never seen them in a style anything like this. So it's the easiest thing to prove. Like, visuals are the easiest thing to prove in a licensing meeting. So we're like, what do you think? And immediately they're like, oh my God, yes, right? They're like, they're chibis, but they're badass, right? They're not anime chibi, but they just feel like something like just fresh and new. I like the artistic vocabulary for it. So my artist friends, I'm sorry. But they're just cool. Mm-hmm. and so, yeah, that was our way in the door. We wanted to do that. Now, granted, because of that aesthetic, we also knew that we wanted to do a game that was a little bit more broad. So Marvel has done some very mass market games in the past for card games, but they haven't really, there's not a lot of mass market board games that also have depth and challenge. So that's what we were aiming at. We wanted to do a game that could go broad. Parents could play with their kids could play together, but also was challenging enough that gamers could enjoy it, right? It's not going to be the most complex game you ever play, but mm-hmm. I promise you, games with simple rules are almost, does not mean that they're easy to play or that they're easy to master, as we know, right? But that's classic game, classic game theory. So we want to make a game that has really super simple surface complexity, but so much hidden emergent depth that just keeps unlocking over time and endless variety. It's Marvel, right? So every character adds a completely new texture to the game. Every villain completely changes the game. I don't know. I could talk about this forever. We were so excited about it. And the core design... Before I start here, am I intruding on other questions?
No. I mean, there's a lot of questions. Yeah, there's a lot of questions that can span from your single answer. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, the core design of the game actually came together in about 24 hours, right? That often happens. Now, this is a co-design with myself and Andrea Carvesio, who designed Kingsburg and Hyperborea, but the two of us, and Munchkin Dungeon with me, we did that together. So we had this amazing chemistry, this amazing Euro and American chemistry that we just, it was so fast. Like I showed him a basic concept, I showed him a table presence, a game that looks like this. He came back with a very simple beginning, so a play pattern. We riffed off that. It was like 24 hours easily for the core game. Now it's changed a lot, of course. Development takes way longer than initial design, but the very core, the way that the bullet points on the back of the box, came together super, super fast. Because both of us are huge Marvel fans. Andrea is even a bigger fan of the comics than I was. He knew the comics by heart. I stopped reading comics about 20 years ago, even though I was a big fan. I'm now the MCU guy, the cinematic universe guy at this point, right? So we had this really cool blend of backgrounds. And so it was great. It was absolutely great. We were able to do most of the design without research because we just knew the characters. Now, I want to be clear. Of course, we went back and we did research. Of course, we have a huge litany of material. But it's important to me that we were able to do the core of it without having to go too inside baseball, too deep. We didn't want to do too many deep cuts. We want to make something that's relatable to a broad number of players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You guys decided that it was more of a co-op game, right? At any point, did you ever have to think that you have to solve the issue with co-op games where there's an alpha in the group and then they just take over the whole experience for everyone?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the quarterback alpha problem. Quickly, I'm sorry, I see that the video is interrupted. Is that all right?
Oh yeah, it's good. It picked back up. Yep, it's fixed.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Yep. So of course, it's co-op 101 at this point, right? And it's I don't consider the question to be how do you solve the alpha player problem? The question is, do you solve the alpha player problem? Ask that first, then go afterwards. So we addressed it, but we didn't solve it. So one of the things that's important to us, especially in broader games, is that the spirit of teamwork is so important that the risk of one player telling other people what to do is much smaller than a group of people who don't know intuitively how to cooperate. So my favorite example, one of the favorite examples here I have is Super Mario for the Nintendo 64. Remember that from way back when?
Mm-hmm.
Mario 64. Sorry, I should go back. Mario World for the GameCube for the Wii with the one player. You can play two players. One player plays Mario and the other one plays the star. They mm-hmm. just move the star around and pick up everything for Mario. Now, to the seasoned gamer, right? The seasoned gamer who's played a million games and for whom agency is the most important thing. They're like, why would anybody want to play that? Well, data suggests a ton of people just want to play the star. They just want to pick. They want to go pick up stuff. And it's important that that they still feel agency because they are the ones doing that important work,
mm-hmm.
right? And they actually do make the game easier for the other player. So we want to make a game that encourages, if they want to, they can completely play the group thing, play with their hands open on the table. And it's and that dynamic will actually manifest throughout the more casual players. Now, if you want to, all you have to do is just hide your hand and they'll solve 75% of your alpha player problems, right? Mm-hmm. But we did not put in the rules. We didn't put in the rules that you have to play with your hand closed. Because it's a co-op game, right? It's your game. You should choose to enjoy it to the level that you want. But we've played it both ways with many different groups. If you play closed hand, it's actually a little difficult. Like you end up playing a lot of, because the game is so focused on pairing up your icons with the last player, you end up having to discuss. You cannot play this game without discussing,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's mm-hmm. and that's the primary interaction of co-op. And I think that's extremely important.
I see. But you mentioned the life of the game and what a revelation, right? That the basis, the skeleton was done in 24 hours of collaboration, just going back and forth. Was the game always designed to be a cooperative game? Was there ever a version of it wherein the villains were basically controlled by a player?
Yes, there was, but not at the beginning. So it was always a co-op game. We sold it. We sold it to our licensors as a co-op game. That is so. the market that we're aiming for, right? The broader market, the gateway market, right? Or gateway plus market. Because remember, we're doing this game in partnership with Spin Master, who's going to be taking this game to retail, and they have a very, very, very broad market reach. Co-op is a really efficient way to sell a game that's slightly more complicated than the mass-produced games they always have. And it was important to us. We did not make a game that was trivial. We wanted to make a game that has real meat to it, real decisions, real drama, real climax. Mm-hmm. That's designing over the basic learning curve of a chunk of our market. Making it co-op allows us to obviate that learning curve to the most seasoned person at the table in each particular situation. We knew it was going to be co-op, no matter what. Now, it's the job of during design to try a whole bunch of different things. So yeah, we tried all the variations, right? Even though the game comes together fast, you're obligated in design to test all these alternate things, even if the conclusion is, oh, I was right in the first place. Right. And so, yeah, we tried a ton of different things and we incorporated, it was always co-op, but we incorporated, like, for example, in Asgard, right? We tried a sort of traitor-esque mechanic in there, which we loved, right? We didn't want to get too crazy with it, but for this audience, a traitor mechanic is something they've never seen before. And in this environment, it's really cool too. And it's very simple. We incorporated a lot of the expansion, incorporate the ideas or at least some of the ideas that we bandied about during the process, but didn't necessarily incorporate into the core, because it's important that the core is a 5-minute teach.
I see.
At any point did you try having a co-op, but then assigning victory points to secret objectives per player? Like, for example,
semi-co-op. I personally hate semi-co-op, in my opinion. it's a personal thing, right? One of my freaking design collaborators, Mike Elliott, came up with a great phrase for it that articulates it. So semi-co-op is just co-op where you feel bad when your friends do well. And I don't like that. I generally prefer, I'm sure, I know that, and I know it's a spectrum, right? I know there's a spectrum of cooperation versus competition, and you can incorporate elements of both. We enjoy the purity of co-op in this particular game because it's Marvel, right? Marvel United, even the name talks about the vision of the game. It's about inescapable teamwork. It's not just your character, it's your team of characters. What does my character do? And what does my character offer to the group? Right? And that's very important. It was the clarity that made this game stand out and gave it a reason to exist, in my opinion.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we didn't try semi-co-op, even though I've designed tons of semi-co-op games and never ever published them for that same reason.
Mm-hmm. So in some sense, Marvel United is like a top-down design. It's basically, this is what we want to... This is what the game is all about. This is what we want to feel, what we want to give players, all the way down from all the mechanics. We want to make sure that they feel united. It's a cooperative in its spirit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Yep. And that's how most of my games are, right? They're designed straight down from a vision.
Definitely. But there's a question here from Edsel. Given that the name Marvel United, it spells everything out, how is the game as a solo play? Do you think that's a possibility here?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And so, let me talk about solo for a second. So, in general, co-op games can be played solo, right? Because if you talk to the cynical, like old crusty gamer guy, like oh, co-op games are just solos with multiple players, right? Sure. Right? there's a little bit of merit to that. But we actually, on our team, so... Ruger Seta and Alexio Schneerberger, who are on our Italian team, they're the two developers on the game that contributed massively to the game, and they did they I can't speak enough about how much they contributed and how good they were to, as an addition. Ruger is a solo player champion, and he was like, his role was to go, we want solo play to be meaningful and different from the core experience, not to change the game, but to have a feel for it. So we bandied about some cool ideas. So there actually are solo variants for the game that put you in the role of the director of S.H.I.E.L.D., where you are, where you, it now has a feeling of you are trying to make your this Marvel team work together, even though they have issues of coordination. So you get, you feel like Nick Fury would be like, oh God, can we just coordinate? Right? Like you're one brain, but not everybody is always on the same page. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So solo play in this game is incredible. I'm really, really proud of it.
I love how they y'all got away with the flavor. It's just you're Nick Fury and you have to force everyone to cooperate.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. We're big believers in that. So I know on every Kickstarter we ever do, everybody says, can we have solo mode? And I hear you, but we don't deliver as a rule. We don't deliver something unless we really feel like it's a good experience that reflects what, the product that we're trying to sell, right? So in this case, solo, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
And at any point, like one of the people I've always asked, and because a lot of us when we got into Marvel, I think it was in the arc of the Civil War,
and
in the Civil War, and then after the Civil War, you had a Secret Invasion, if I remember correctly. At any point, did you think about adding Secret Invasion or a Civil War concept into Marvel United?
So okay. I have to be a little cagey here because it's a licensed game, right? So I have to be, you know, I can't be, I have to admit some stuff, right? So assume this. Any question that begins with, did you consider X, where X is an element of the Marvel Universe that is well known? The answer is always yes. Mm-hmm. Of course we did. The reasons are not always, we're dealing with a licensed game and we're dealing with licensors of a very, very strongly integrated property that know way more than we do, any of us, right? Like these people have years of vision into the future, right? Including even down to the choice of the characters for the core box was edited by Marvel. They were very clear on one particular choice, and I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it yet. There's a choice that seems a little off in the core box, and you'll see next year why it's not off, right? And they knew this 3 years ago, right? So I can never say why we didn't incorporate something, but assume we considered it, especially if it's a really well-known storyline.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That actually builds up into a question asked by one of our friends, Gino. He asked, how do you choose the characters, story arcs, locations represented in Marvel United? Were there any favorites of yours that didn't make it? That was his question.
That favorites that didn't make it. Oh yeah, absolutely. I can't tell you who.
All right. Okay.
For reasons, but yeah. So how do they get chosen? So this is interesting. It's a little different for this game than it is for a lot of our other licensed games. Marvel, Disney, the licensors are very, very involved in the product design portion of it. So we pitch some ideas, but they come back with strong counter suggestions. And we don't even always get to ask why, right? I mean, we can, but they'll say, no, we can't tell you. Just trust me, do this instead.
Just do this, right? Yeah.
Just do this, trust me, it'll pay off, right? Of course they can't, right? Because they're under so much secrecy, I totally get it. And I'm a little glad because I'm a huge fan of the cinematic universe. I don't want spoilers, right? But we made a pitch. We made a pitch for the core box, which had a slightly different makeup from what you see. And they didn't want that. They said, nope, try this instead. So the final versions of everything you see is as approved by Marvel, and in some cases, as suggested by Marvel. So from my point of view, this is where Andrea and I's background comes in, right? So I actually wanted to follow the cinematic universe as much as possible. Even though our license is for the comics, right? We base it on the comics, and we don't, anything that you see in our game is in the comics. So what I did is I sourced as much as possible for the overlap between the comics and the cinematic universe,
yeah,
right? So that it can appeal to everybody who's in the Marvel.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's why you see, like, you know, the Asgardians, the Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Because, I mean, honestly, Guardians of the Galaxy were not that popular as a comic, right?
Yeah.
It took the movies to really bring them to light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but they were in the comics, and we stuck to the comics as our source material. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's basically it. I mean, the short version is we had ideas, but Marvel said they said, these are your final products. Here you go. So it's almost a 50-50 collaboration.
Yeah, that's actually another thought I had, because I was looking at the little miniatures and some of them were very like MCU costume based, right? Because you have the legacy costumes, you have the Golden Age costumes, but I think it's come to the point where the movies are so popular and they're so universal, no pun intended, that even the costumes pick up on them, like the comics. They're like, all right, for this run, we're gonna take a little bit of a cue from their latest movie and put it in, and that's exactly how it is. And I think that's what makes Marvel United so great, is because you represent the characters in chibi form, yes, but in their most popular look. So people automatically gravitate towards, oh, look at this. It's this character as I know them.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, everything you said and more. I mean, we're such Marvel fans, right? I mean, everybody. So even down to the producer of this game, Thiago Aranha, who's the same producer who's worked on all of our Mythic games. He's a huge. I mean, so his last name Aranha is Spider in Portuguese, where he comes from. So like his profile pic is now Spider-Man from Marvel United everywhere, right? He is such a huge fan that he had strong opinions. So there was. I mean, there's back and forth everywhere, and we're I'm trying to dial it down a little bit, but it's really hard not to talk about the United without getting excited about it, because any opportunity to work on a Marvel game, I'm really, 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 I'm just pumped.
Yeah. Safe to say, you're just excited for most everything inside Marvel United. Before we leave the topic, there's one more thing you mentioned about Spider-Man. I think people who are like eagle-eyed noticed that Spider-Man kind of changed his model halfway or some way through the campaign. Can you tell us about that?
I mean,
he's the one that looked a little bit like Miles Morales, yeah?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I'm just. I have to be a little careful.
Oh, I see. It's one of those questions, right?
Yeah. I have to be careful because, of course, it's a licensed game, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't have 100% insight into what happened. I mean, I know how we made our choices because we try to be responsive to backers every chance we get, right? And as you know, when we do a Kickstarter, we have a lot of preparation to do. Plastic models take ages to make. So it's not like we can just go like, oh, let's just change something. Boom, here it goes. Yeah. If we do, it's an all hands on deck situation. And that disrupts the entire company, right? Well, not really the entire, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So we, in this particular case, we agreed like, all right, like we can make some improvements. And it was worth disrupting our chain. Now, there was licensing issues there, of course, right? It had to get approved. So I can't talk about what happened behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm frankly surprised that that got pulled off. I think it's great. I think it's a great message to send to our backers that we're listening. But I cannot overemphasize how difficult that is to do, especially when you're dealing with a license this grand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just really glad we did it.
Yeah, I think...
I remember a story that from Singapore office that you had one person just be in the Disney office all day just trying to follow up on the approvals and stuff. So I'm pretty sure it was crazy to just change that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's tough. It's tough, right? I mean, they've got a lot of stuff to do. They're not just doing our game too, right?
So... Yeah.
compare sizes.
And then there's a follow-up question on the comments also. Edsel also asked, any plans on a season 2?
so we are Simon. We are Kaman, right? we make big games that we are proud of, games that are successful. We like to support games that are successful. That is all I'm allowed to say.
All right, good call on that one. Good call on that one.
So I guess the main message there is make it successful.
Right. I mean, we consider the Kickstarter quite successful, right? And the retail should be. I think I'm making my own predictions, of course, because I'm proud of the game and I'm extremely biased. I think the game's going to do amazing at retail. Amazing, because it's going to have that. It's going to have a reach that we've never had before. Our partners in Spin Master, they have a global reach, like in the global mass market. And the this was my dream. The dream is to expose the game to an audience who has never seen our style of design before, mm-hmm. and literally be gateway into the CMON style. So this project was. I mean, it's really the reason why I came on board, right? To broaden the scope of our games, to broaden the reach of our games.
All right.
I was very, when I first saw it, and when you first showed me some of the details about the game, I was expecting Arcadia Quest with Marvel on it, but totally changes everything after that. And I was really happy about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I have no issues with reskinning old games if there's a good reason to do it. But I don't want to release a game. I don't want to release a game just to earn money. And I know we're a publicly traded corporation. We're not supposed to say that. But like, but really, like our business model is we make stuff that we believe people will love.
Yeah.
Right. And in order to do that, we have to love it ourselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's totally totally fine as an artist, right? As you're both in the business and you're also an artist still at your core. So you don't want to just make something because it can make money. But yeah, it's also important.
Sure.
But
and they're not mutually exclusive, right?
Yeah.
I mean, quality is the best business model, yeah. In my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. but this whole discussion for the past, 15-20 minutes has been eye-opening to me. Because I like Hans, especially in the first early days of Marvel United, had the same idea. Okay, so it's like a dungeon delve, it's like a little adventure game with miniatures, but with the Marvel IP. That's what I thought, but with this discussion, I'm like, alright, so it's more of a strategic attack at the gateway format.
Yeah, it's closer. Let's say it's closer to games like Pandemic than it is to Arcadia Quest, right? Mm-hmm. But just with a lot, it's a lot more top-down designed and a lot more plug and play, right? So mm-hmm. we want to make a really simple engine, but with a lot of hooks and a lot of robust space to add a huge amount of variety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's the perfect segue into our second game, our second main topic of the night, which is Ankh, which is as far away from the gateway as one could get, at least from the same designer, right? Ankh is the third I'm just taking it off of context clues here. Did you say the myth trilogy?
Well, right. We don't have an official name for it. It's unofficially called the Mythic Trilogy.
The Mythic Trilogy. There you go.
Some of our people call it the Legendary Series. Mm-hmm. Like it's just got. I get in trouble for this. It's like the Matrix, right? We made a great game, and then we're like, obviously, we meant this is going to be a trilogy, right?
that's my first question. Like you can ask Hans. It's in our little document here. That was my first question. Is Ankh, Rising Sun, Blood Rage, I'm going backwards. Was it always a planned trilogy?
From the beginning, no. But close to the beginning. So Blood Rage came from way before I started at Kamon. But after the success of like Chaos Ball and Arcadia Quest, and I had gotten really, really close to CMON team at the time. And I was like, I really loved working with them. And the idea of designing a game for Kickstarter was thrilling to me, right? Now we've done games like Zombicide, we've done games like Arcadia Quest, which are giant, huge expansion driven games. What if we did just a board game, which is kind of where Blood Rage came from? And now Blood Rage is a game I've wanted to do forever. And there's a long story behind that, and I don't know how much time we have, but like, so the short version goes, Blood Rage came from, I grew up reading mythology, folktales and legends from German sources when I was visiting my grandmother in Germany when I was a little kid. So I have this like sort of twisted German interpretation of all these world mythologies that I read from this kid's book. I loved it. It was my primary source of entertainment, and this just kind of informed all of my storytelling, all of my everything I love about entertainment. So I want to go back and revisit that, right? And so I love Viking mythology. I'm named after a Viking, right? I did a German Euro game called Midgard in like 2005. Which is Vikings with drafting, which I thought was, I'm very proud of it, but it's a Euro game, right? It was a very light sort of entry level Euro game, but I commissioned this really cool John Gravato cover with a Viking at the end of the world and comics and stuff. That cover did not match the gameplay at all, and it hurt sales quite a bit. That was my fault, by the way, not the publisher's. So I kept looking at that cover from time to time. Right, I'm like, God, I love that cover. I want to make the game that cover promised. Mm-hmm. And that's where Blood Rage came from. So it's an evolution of that old design made in my current style. Like it's a big game. It's epic in scope, but it's still pared down to be as simple and accessible as possible. While I was working on Blood Rage, I realized I was onto something special. Like this, it was fun. Again, 24 hours was the first design. And it was, it was already fun, even when it was unbalanced and broken and unfinished. This game is really special. And then that's when I started thinking, well, what other myths did I remember growing up on? And Ankh was actually my second one. I was like, oh, I want to do an Egypt game. But I didn't have a great idea for it. And the game Kemet had just come out.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I don't need to do it. Kemet's great. I don't want to do a game like that. I did Rising Sun because I had the great idea to do a negotiation diplomacy game. That's what put that second. And Ankh, I designed, started working on in the middle of Rising Sun. And I even designed a full game of Ankh, which was Rising Sun with pyramids, basically. it was fine. It was a fine game, but it was like, I've already done that. So I threw it away and didn't work on it again until, aha, you're the gods themselves. Because in Egypt, gods can merge together and become one. That's a new hook. That's something different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're the gods that are trying to win the devotion of your followers rather than the leader of a clan trying to go to war. So you still get gods, you still get monsters, you still get cool characters, but you have a very different feel. That's where Ankh came from. And these are the three most personal mythologies to me, the ones that I know that I know the most. There are some others that I'm not doing for various reasons, but this feels like a trilogy to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't start as a trilogy, not originally.
It didn't, nope.
Yeah,
not originally. Okay. It naturally fit though.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like we knew it was gonna be a series way before Blood Rage even hit Kickstarter. So it did hit early. Because I started working on Rising Sun in the middle of Blood Rage.
Okay. Mythic trilogy, legendary series. Do you have like a preference as to what to call it personally? Which one hits home for you?
Now if Mythic trilogy seems it fits, right?
All
right. Because even if I do more Mythic games, they'll probably have a different. They might have a different vibe to it, right? Mm-hmm. They'll probably be part of the legendary series. For now, like these three games really fit together. Of course, I have ideas. I know everybody asks, like, "Oh, do you have ideas for more?" Of course, I do. But these three really feel like a unit.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this Ankh puts a really nice bow on that package.
Uh-huh. I like how whenever we talk about Ankh, because that's where the spotlight is right now. We can't help but always at least look back to or mention Rising Sun and Blood Rage. I gotta ask, since a live gameplay or like a teaser or a look at the gameplay is yet to happen, because I think you're about to do that very soon, yeah? Like at least later on today, if I'm not mistaken?
Well, we can't play the game on Zoom. That's the problem, right? Because we're all separated, right? Mm-hmm. But we actually did. I mean, we planned a gameplay video for this, like everything else. But then COVID hit in the middle of it, and it shut down all of our. Because you know we like to do these well produced.
Yeah.
Like you know, like come on level stuff. So and that shut us down completely. We tried several other solutions, but at home, I even tried thinking about filming a tabletop simulator demo, but it was garbage. It looked like our module looks very nice, mm-hmm. and our graphics look really nice. But I mean, I'm technologically restricted. I'm sitting here with a laptop that is not that powerful.
Yeah.
So like, it looked like it was unwatchable. We tried. We really tried. Now we actually wrote up. What we did is we took what we were going to write for a gameplay thing, played out a game. And we're actually writing it, and so it's Kickstarter updates right now. Basically transcribe that with visual examples, and we actually use the Office Cats of Brazil as our players, which is pretty cute.
So with that in progress, like currently as we're speaking, it's going up, and later on in the afternoon, you'll have a show on YouTube via stream as well to talk about that. I think I gotta ask, at least for our viewers right here right now, is Ankh? Here comes the question. Is Ankh more Blood Rage, or is it more Rising Sun, or is it something totally new? Is it wildly different from both?
Yeah, it's neither. So, okay, this trilogy is, the pillars of this trilogy are monsters, gods, warriors, area control. From a mythology, obviously, right? That's it. That's the connective tissue between them, right? And I have a particular style of area control that I like. And I like, you know, area control where there's combat, but it's not always about winning the combat. It's about what you can get out of combat, right? And there's lots of ways to explore that space. It turns out there's lots of ways to explore that. So Blood Rage is the most pure combat focused version, right? Where combat is simple and straightforward, but it's deepened by the fact that you have to manage your tools, like what can I use combat cards, or do I also manage quests and upgrades? That's there. Rising Sun has a much more involved combat with bidding and negotiation even inside the combat. That was where this came. So Ankh obviously has combat too, but Ankh is a deteriorating management game. Right, so you are playing, in this you're playing the gods that are being forgotten over a timeline as the civilization of Egypt goes from polytheism to monotheism. And so you have to remain relevant and build monuments in your honor and win combats when you can as a show of strength and build up your Ankh powers to build up a devotion engine. So this game, unlike Rising Sun and Blood Rage, does have a victory point track. It has something called a devotion track, which has upward and downward mobility. You will move up and sometimes down on devotion. You win. Somebody wins the game immediately if they hit the top, but they even have a chance of being eliminated from the game like near the end. Don't worry, I'm not crazy.
All right,
but but there's a point near the end of the game where if you're still in the red for devotion, you're gone. So you can't just. It really gives you that feeling of like, yes, you're an all powerful god, but you need your people to survive, right? And of course, it has a couple of features that I've never done in area control game before, and I've seen very seldom, if ever, right? So like, there's a point in the timeline in the game where it's a competitive game, 2 to 5 players, but two players will merge at the end of the game and become one. So those two players will play cooperatively, pure cooperatively. They will win or lose together as their two gods fuse. The two bottom gods will fuse together, become one god, gain both of their powers, and double the turns. And so even though you're at the bottom of the track, you have a shot at going at literally catching up and pulling up to the end. So basically, using a piece of Egyptian mythology as a catch-up mechanism is something that really appealed to me. And it's a very powerful catch-up mechanism. And also, it has some interactions that I haven't seen in games like this before, right? Where you're managing where you want to be on the devotion track, but it's not always, how do I go up as fast as I possibly can? It's who, like, there's some point in the game where you're like, oh wait, based on what I do, this is going to inform who I merge with or don't. So it's just different, right? It's a different experience. And I didn't want to make this game if you could get all these experiences just from Rising Sun or Blood Rage. Those two games are out there, they exist. So this game has to earn its place on the shelf and have a different experience, even though it has some commonalities.
Yeah, yeah. I like now with the potential to play the game in a very specific way that you could not have done so in the past with Blood Rage and Rising Sun. That alone, that potential to say by the end of the game you'll take the two lowest players, and it can be a strategy. Like, I plan, well, I'm not sure if it's possible, but I plan to be in the bottom so that I can play co-op and then win with my partner. That's something, sure, you could walk in. Like, it's like in Blood Rage when you're playing Loki style, you're saying, I'm gonna lose these battles and get a lot of points. You can do the same thing in Ankh and say, I'm gonna lose a lot, or early on go down in devotion and then partner up.
You absolutely can plan for that. Now, of course, these games are intensely tactical, right? So you have to, they're one of the things I love about these kind of games and about area control in general is they are as tactical as they are strategic. So you must be adaptable and you must react to other players. They're deeply, deeply interactive games. Right. So if you're bothered by people being able to mess with your plans, then maybe it's not the game for you. But if you like really interactive games, this is as intense and interactive as you can possibly get.
I can dig it. You mentioned
with really simple rules.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of games earlier. This is a question coming in from the crowd. Michael's asking, which do you prefer from that family of games? Kemet or Cyclades? It's another series. Do you prefer one or the other?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. So I will actually say I prefer Cyclades. There's a non-objective reason. It was the first game of the series I played, of course. And I played a long, long time ago, right before it came out. The idea of bidding on monsters in a fighty Euro game was like, that was just new to me. I was like, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like the victory condition of Kemet better, better than Cyclades. But I have to admit, I like the art in Cyclades better. And I know that theoretically isn't supposed to inform gameplay, but it totally does. Like, I like the look and the feel of it, and I like the way they incorporated their mythology a little bit more than Kemet. But I mean, it's close, right? I love both games.
Very close, very close. Yeah.
If, for example, you have a new player who has just gone down all of these Gateway Plus games. Like, for example, he started out with Marvel United. Mm-hmm. He went to Gizmos, Potion Explosion, and then decided that he wants a Meteor game. And then from the Kumon titles, you have Ankh, assuming that it's out already in retail, Blood Rage, or Rising Sun. Which first game would you recommend that he picks out of the three?
I actually think that's a really good question. You know what? I don't get asked that often, this particular one. I'd actually recommend playing them in order. I would play Blood Rage first, then Rising Sun, mm-hmm. and then Ankh. I think part of what people will appreciate with Ankh is how different it is from other area control games of that type.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just starting, you won't appreciate the differences that much, right? It'll just I think you could start with anyone, to be honest, but if you mm-hmm. really want the journey, I would do the three in that order. I would definitely play Blood Rage before Rising Sun because Blood Rage is a more direct game. I know some people have told me that Rising Sun's a deeper game, and I mean, obviously as the designer, I feel like all three games have depth to it, but I think that the depth in Blood Rage is a little bit more subtle, right? Like, obviously, it's the most intuitive of the three games. I go out, I pillage, I raise my stats, I get points. But, I mean, there's a lot of subtlety inside that structure that you don't have to get on your first game.
Yeah.
and that's fine. In Rise of Sun, you have to get some of the subtleties of negotiation even in your first game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like in Blood Rage, I noticed that the tech three, the card drafting was a totally different game unto itself. Right. We've gotten to the point that we just like in Agricola, you have those tier A cards that must be like a first pick usually. In Rising Sun, it's not that predominant, except for the dog. We just call it the dog. It's like
the dog. I know exactly. The dog. And you know what's funny? During our playtest, we playtested like hundreds of times. Playtesters complained that the dog was too weak. I was like, nope. What?
It's
one of the times. I don't overrule playtesters that often because data beats intuition, but sometimes I'm like, nope.
Do it again. Nope. You're playing it wrong. Do it again.
No, they're like, you got to buff it. I'm like, nope.
But in Rising Sun, aside from that, we felt that the game was really more on. Actually, the way I play Rising Sun is I never want to be ahead after two rounds. I always want to be in the middle.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. That's classic. Right?
Yeah. In Ankh,
being in the middle is death. It's the opposite. Ankh is a game of high low, right?
Yeah.
And so you have to decide. And so there's so many ways to do it, right? And it's hard to I can spout some strategies here, but until you know the game, it may not make a lot of sense. But what you're doing, if you're looking at it from a pure player point of view and you're discounting the theme and everything, is you're building a devotion engine, right? And how do I build it? Is it going to be slow and steady? Is it going to be bursty? Is it going to be focused on denial of my opponents? Because hurting your opponent, like sending your opponents down, is also viable, right? Mm-hmm. And situationally, where based on how you're doing, do you want to play? Who do you think you want to merge with if you're going to be lower on the track? If you're aiming right for the middle, you're toast. Second place is the worst in this game. Mm-hmm. Right now, luckily, it's dynamic enough that second place is very dynamic, right? And there's one other thing. More so than the other two games, the asymmetry of Ankh is apparent. Like you have to play your god too. Your god doesn't tell you how to gain devotion. Your god gives you some direction how to play.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So every god has strengths and weaknesses that you have to take into account. Not only yours, but your opponent's as well.
That just makes sense to me. Thematically speaking as well, I mean, besides how the game will work mechanically, but thematically speaking, at least, you'd rather be the god everybody remembers or the one god that fused with the other and you're on your way up. If you're in the middle, you're like,
that's right.
Who dat? You're right.
Who dat? Yep, that's right. Yeah, nobody remembers number two. That's right.
In terms of the gods, do you think there will be a lot of different learning curves for those gods? Because, for example, in Rising Sun, I remember there were some clans that were just, if you're a beginner, they're the super easiest to begin with. Like, for example, I remember the Turtle clan is like super strong. The Fox, you need several playthroughs just to understand it. Will it be the same in Ankh, to a degree.
I mean, mm-hmm. I feel like the core box gods are slightly more straightforward, slightly, which is one of the reasons why they're in the core box. Mm-hmm. Besides thematically being what they are, I try to balance keeping them thematically true to their identity and also. Also balanced in terms of difficulty and power level, of course, right? it never works out that way, right? You can never, no asymmetrical game is balanced on all vectors all the time. It's impossible. So I would say, I have my own ideas on who is this the most intuitive, but I've been proven wrong by several times in playtesting, depending on who we're playing with, right? I've had several people inside Kaman who played the game that said Anubis is actually the most straightforward. I'm like, okay. Mostly, I guess it's because his power is really passive. Right, it just it's something that his power just changes the game. It's something that happens when people die, you get them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not something that you have to actively work on, but it's something you have to play around. You absolutely do, right? So there's there, even though some of the gods are like semi-obvious, like Osiris, right? Osiris likes to lose early so he can build up portals to the nether, to the underworld. But losing all the time too early sets back your devotion engine badly. So it's not that obvious. So there's a learning curve to each one, right? The obvious way to play each god and a little bit more of a textured way to play your god and a reactive way, right? Not only do you have to know how to play your god, but you have to know how to play against other gods.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah. That basically sounds like the core box of any of the mythic trilogy games, like the clans or
Well, Blood Rage, everyone starts the same. It's really
right. Blood Rage is symmetrical. Yeah.
Do we have? Let me check.
We have one question here coming in from JC, Mr. Store. You guys have met. He's asking, is it, well, you cannot answer this given that it's very in the future type of question. Have you ever considered creating crossover cards to port a set of monsters or gods from one game in the series to another?
I mean, of course. Of course, mm-hmm. I've considered it.
Of course.
No.
Never. Okay.
So, well, no. So I mean, look, it may happen, but it'll be under protest, right? Like, to me, the three games are part of a series, but the differences between them, it's very important to me that each game earns a place on your shelf, right? And so, in order to do that, I want to make sure they're different experiences. If I could effortlessly cross over components between them, then why do you have three different games, right? So, now, like, yeah, we thought about doing conversions and stuff, but like, I mean, I see the appeal, right? I played IP mashup games in the past, but I don't know, like, it doesn't appeal to me. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. I may change my mind in the future, but just to me, it just seems a little silly, and I don't see the appeal right now.
Yeah, right now, it's just not there. Yeah.
So one of the things that I've always wanted to do in terms of events for community building is we like to throw tournaments and events, but with different games stacked onto them. So, for example, one of the things that we were actually planning for All Aboard was to have like a King of Roll and Write.
Okay. Well, he has a question that we addressed earlier about the design of Marvel United as to why the miniatures are chibi versions of the characters. So, dude, you can watch the video again. It's answered in the first half of the video. Just check it out. But yeah, before we knock this whole question and answer little interview out, let's throw you some questions, Eric, that comes from the community that are not exactly about Marvel United specifically or about Ankh.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and you can just hit this like real quick, wham bam, as brief or as a detail as you want. Here's one from Dom. Dom says, I think this came from like your visit, your first visit to Manila or your second, one or the other. But he says that maybe during an interview at one of your press releases here in the Philippines, you mentioned that working on or maybe cooking up a game about Manila traffic. What's the progress on that?
I'll be honest, I haven't revisited it. It's one of those games that's in the back of my head. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I honestly don't know if I'll ever make it, but it's a really fun thought exercise.
All right. Crossing fingers. I really hope we see that, at least in my lifetime, because I want a game about traffic in Manila as well.
You know what? Maybe I'll collaborate with a Filipino designer.
Possibly.
Oh.
Possibly. Here's a question from Ben, one of our curators. What games have you personally been playing during the lockdown? Not necessarily for work, but what have you been getting into?
Oh, man, I've been so lazy. A true professional would be like, oh yes, I decided to explore all these millions of new game genres. Like, now I played Hearthstone and WoW. Like, at the end of the day, I'm working on games 9 hours a day, and when I'm done, I pretty much just want to relax with something that I already know how to play and I don't have to think too hard.
Yep. All right. Sounds good. I love how you said Hearthstone, because the newest expansion, Ashes of Outlands, just introduces the biggest change, I think, in Hearthstone in years. So what are your thoughts on Demon Hunter? I just want to hear this from you, because I jumped into Ashes of Outlands hard as well. So what do you think? Demon Hunter.
Sure. So I mean, it's... I love how powerful they made it. And I knew they were going to nerf it. I mean, I've worked in development for many years. Everything that they did seems logical to me, including the 24-hour nerf. It's fine. They have to be strong. They're not my favorite class. I played them for a while. I was like, oh, it's neat. I like the just sheer power level of it. It didn't change my opinion of what my favorite classes are, which are still... I still like the mid-range control classes like priest or warlock. But generally the set's fun. I mean, they've done a really good job of making the types of decks that are fun to play also get decks that can win. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to do in a CCG, mm-hmm. right? Where most strategies are based on denial of some kind. That's the most efficient way to win games. It's really hard to balance. I know this. Mm-hmm. So props to them.
Yeah.
Props to them.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, they have, it's got issues, like every set has issues. There are decks I certainly don't enjoy playing against, and that will never change, but it is what it is. I've been playing Battlegrounds like crazy, though.
Oh, yeah.
I love Battlegrounds. Battlegrounds is exactly the short attention span auto battler that was made just for me.
Yeah.
Right? It's simple. Uh-huh. Subtle, and there's still a learning curve.
Yeah, yeah. It's the nothing game that still makes you think. It's an auto battler, Hans. It's literally Hearthstone, wherein you buy the cards and then you place them, and then they just fight. And it's auto chess. It's an auto battler. That's Hearthstone.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's simple and subtle. I love it.
Yeah, it's again, it feels like a nothing game, but there's a lot behind the meat. All right, so a lot of Hearthstone, a lot of Warcraft, World of Warcraft, that is. Hope you got the answer, Ben. Benj here, I think you answered this earlier. You gave us a little bit of a teaser as to how the answer to this question is, but how do you choose the themes for your games?
Oh, there's two things, right? I design games in one of two ways, right? Number one, it's based on off of a brief or a need, right? Especially as the game director of Come On, right? There are things that I know strategically we need to make, right? And sometimes I assign them to people on my team. Sometimes I know I have to be the one to make them. So that's chosen for me. But I have to love the theme no matter what. Even if it's for me, I can't work on it if I don't love the theme. And then the other one is it's pure inspiration. Never plan, right? I don't go thinking, oh man, I should really make a game about worker placement, right? I never think like that. If I aspire to make a game, I don't just think about it, I just go prototype something. Sometimes it's like, I don't care, it's no good, but that 10th time, not, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, I have ideas for games basically, not every day, but pretty close. Right, and I just most of the time fall away and go like, oh, I hope somebody else makes it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So speaking of themes, here's one interesting question. It's a follow-up from Benj. What are your thoughts on Southeast Asian themes? Given that in this region, at least, there's a rapidly growing economy, huge populations. How come there aren't many Southeast Asian themed games there?
I think there are, actually. I think that I've seen tons. I've been pitched a ton of games, especially in Singapore and Malaysia, which is, of course, where I was based. I think the issue is that the market is very fractured right now. So games that the games that are locally produced don't seem to have critical mass. I don't know if you have the infrastructure for it, but no, there's no dearth of ideas down there. Now, granted, just like in North America, 9 out of 10 games is very derivative and just sort of follows popular trends, right? Or is the original design exercise that every designer's got to do, right? I'm going to make chess but better, or Mahjong but better, or Romance of the Three Kingdoms but better, or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the games are like that. But no, I've seen some really interesting stuff. Taiwan has some crazy interesting themes. Most of them ridiculous and cute animal anthropomorphic stuff. No, I've seen a lot. Now, the ones I've seen games that are built based on political themes. Those usually tend to be like design student exercises for the most part, right? So like, just, you know, here's your standard take back game, right? Which is Uno with more complication and less depth. And I put a Malaysian government theme.
Yeah.
Korean government theme or whatever, right? I see tons of those. Mm-hmm. It's not a lack of creativity. It's just a lack of infrastructure. You will guaranteed see more Southeast Asian games as the market becomes a little bit more connected. Mm-hmm. And I mean, not to toot our own horn, and of course it's my company, Kaman is making a lot of strides in that arena connecting those communities with some kind of distribution infrastructure. So just give it a few years.
I see. I guess you could say, short end of it, it's just a matter of breaking the market, right? It's a lot of it is within the region. And if you're not looking, you won't see it, but it's there. It's all there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
We have one last question coming in from Jericho. And this one is a perfect question for you. Long-standing member of the industry, a pioneer. How do you find innovation in a wildly growing industry? And that's an understatement, I think. With games released, thousands of games released every year, how do you find that spark?
Oh, still? Yeah. You, when you say, like, when I'm looking for a game, looking at other people's games or looking for my own?
Either, like, whichever gets you going. Like, how do you even...
I mean, innovation's everywhere. I mean, I find it, and I know when I see it, right? Mm-hmm. So I go to conventions. Unfortunately, not this year, but... I go to conventions, and I always go to the indie tables, always, right? I look for the tables run by one or two little, like, a mom-and-pop company, or a dad and their kid, or mom and their kid, whatever. I look for the games that are really offbeat. That's, I mean, innovation's all over the place there. It's, you can't contrive it, right? Like, you think, you come up with ideas as time goes on, and generally speaking, when something feels fresh, you know it. You just know it. And that's one of the things that makes me want to work on it. I actually had a really fresh idea for a game the other day, I think just last week. Like, oh, I haven't seen a game that does this in a long time, or at least, very, very long time. So I started working on it, and who knows? I'm not super excited about it, but it's fresh.
All right, so I guess a lot of...
Yeah, I'm sorry, there's no scientific approach here.
Yeah,
right? There's no process.
A lot of the innovation hunting happens with intuition. So if it comes through, you see it, you know what it is, but it's just everywhere.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sometimes driven by necessity, sometimes driven by ignorance, right? People just don't underform. So they make these brand new mistakes in interesting new ways. That's why I'm not only looking for the most established designers to get games from. I look for fresh, new voices from different communities, different backgrounds. Right? There's a lot of our gaming audience is as diverse as the population, right? But our pool of professionals may not be as diverse as we think. So I think by expanding outward beyond the affluent dude in their mid the 20s to 40s, like I try to look, see what people from different backgrounds can offer. I've sent some really cool stuff.
Exciting, exciting. Hans, before we wrap this up, is there anything else you want to throw Eric's way? You want to hear from him?
Yeah, actually, as a way to wrap things up, given that conventions are one of the main ways where we hear exciting news about new releases, what's upcoming, what's being anticipated. But with conventions now postponed or delayed to next year, I guess... What can the community look forward to from Kumon this year? I know we have Marvel United and Ankh, but I'm sure we have a lot of things in the pipeline. What are you most excited about that Kumon is about to release for 2020?
I mean, so you're fishing for spoilers is what you're doing. We are going to make an announcement for a Kickstarter game. I think that the community's been didn't know they were anticipating, but I think they're going to realize, oh my God, yes, I can't wait. We're going to make an announcement for that probably in a couple months. That's all I can tell you. Everybody knows I'm working on games for based on Cyberpunk 2077, mm-hmm. The computer game. I'm working on those. In fact, the laptop that I'm talking to right now is sitting on top of the prototype for one of those games. And Ooh. No, I'm not going to show you. No, I'm super excited about that. I mean, I grew up on Cyberpunk, the role-playing game. And so I'm super, super excited about that one. But that's not coming out this year. That's coming out God knows how long.
Ooh.
Because so far, what we know that's going to come out from Kumon is Sheriff of Nottingham, the second version.
Yep.
That one's everyone's waiting for.
We have Fairy Tale Inn, which is a two-player game, which designed by Paolo Mori and Remo Consadori. That game, the pitch is Connect Four with special powers. And it's as cool as it sounds. It's even cooler than it sounds. I'm so proud of it. We've been working on it for a long time. The problem is it's a retail release, so it's delayed, like everything else, because of the disrupted distribution channel. I don't know when it's coming out. I have a game by Phil Walker Harding in the pipeline that we've been working on for 2 years. It's just very, very difficult production-wise, so I can't say much about it.
Hans is so happy.
I have a game designed by myself and Mike Elliott that is very different from anything you've ever seen by us. Like just crazy whimsical family game. I'm so proud of, but it also has intense production challenges that we've been trying to solve for God knows how long. Maybe next year, maybe the year after, I don't know. Like everything I'm working on right now that I'm excited about, you're not going to see for God knows. Everything that you're about to see is stuff that we stopped working on a long time ago.
Well, when you mentioned Phil Walker Harding, I keep playing Silver and Gold. It's been so good. And right before that, Gizmos and Gingerbread House, which are really good games as well. So we're really excited with whenever a game it comes from Phil Walker.
Oh, Phil's amazing. Not only is a designer, he's a great human being. I just love working with him. Mm-hmm.
Good to hear that there's a nice slew of projects from Kumon and of course from you personally coming in the future. So I guess even if 2020 has beaten us up really hard early on, there's still stuff to look forward to. To wrap up the stream earlier, I'd like to ask for a favor. You were showing us some toys. Would it be fair to show some of our friends watching right now some of those stuff that you were touting around? What is this?
I mean, we're talking about Ankh, of course, right?
Okay,
so
nice.
I have a prototype of Ankh that I'm playing around with. This is plastic. So we've shown resins before. This is actually plastic in close to the final colors of the final production. So let me see. So let me let's do this in order here because I love being a tease here, right? So all right, so there's a warrior of Isis, right? Ooh. Just hanging out, it's doing a thing. That's about the same scale as Blood Rage.
Nice.
Okay. Right? There's a all right, here's a there you go. There's a warrior of Ra. Right? It's got it's Kopesh there, and it's like ooh, pretty cool, right? Like they're not all the same size, and they're all not like we want to make sure their silhouettes are cool. Mm-hmm. Right now, of course. It would not be Ankh without monsters. Roar!
Right. Scorpion!
There's the scorpion, right? Right, there's of course. And check it out, yeah? See, there's even a mummy.
Oh!
Right, I mean, tell me that's not cool, right?
These all come in the right? Base, right? These are all base figurines.
Everything is corset. Okay.
All right.
There's the Andro Sphinx.
Right?
Oh! Little you this, right?
Oh,
right, it's pretty cool. Of course, right? There's Apep, right?
Alligator monster.
The crocodile.
Yep, crocodile?
The crocodile and who is also known as a snake. I know you guys. I know Kickstarter backers. I know, but we're showing the crocodile.
Okay.
There he is. Rawr. Now I'm going to keep him up, right? Because here's my warrior bra, right? Here's my warrior bra, and this is you. This is Ra. Right? That's you. I just want. I love the comparison, right? Uh-oh. So the gods in this are ridiculous.
How many gods in the base? Can you answer that already,
five.
Or can you five?
Yeah,
can. All right,
five. There are five in the base,
and right? each god has only one set of traits and powers. Yeah,
correct.
Okay,
correct.
And then you can just be creative with that. Who is this?
Right. This. What do you mean? Who is this?
I mean, which god is this?
I can forgive you. All right. So there's Anubis.
That was Ra. Uh-huh, Anubis.
There's Anubis. There's Ra.
Osiris.
There's Isis. There's Amun. And there's Osiris.
Okay. All right.
Right? There's Osiris.
Oh God! Whoa! He's bigger.